The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Word exhort in Pali, and it comes from it comes originally from the word to take up. It's causative, so it means to cause, to take something up, to pick something up. It's also used in the idea to cause someone to agree to something. And then that's what the word comes from, and the particular word, the full word of it. The dictionary gives the words like to cause something to be aroused, or to incite, or to instigate. So to instigate someone, to arouse someone, to get someone to agree to, you know, live by the precepts. So that's the kind of, so I don't know if that gives you a little different association to the word than the word exhort.
Could it be to inspire someone?
Probably not. I mean, that word has so many connotations of emotional connotations that probably it would probably be a stretch from the original. But I don't know. We don't know. You know what it was like for Pali speakers. And maybe they all started crying here at the word because it's so moving. Who knows? It's amazing how little we know, and we're kind of just guessing almost in the dark. But these people who lived in the Bronze Age. So in terms of one of the ethical issues that people have is the idea of eating meat. And it's an ethical issue which Buddhists have addressed in a variety of ways over the centuries. And there are whole schools of Buddhism that Mahayana scriptures, Mahayana sutras, that are very clear that the Buddha was teaching don't eat meat. And the most famous one is the Lankavatara Sutra. And the other one is the Mahayana text called the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. And there's a few others at all. It's very, very clear, don't eat meat. And then in the Mahayana monastic traditions of China and Korea, the monastics are, part of their rules is to be vegetarian and not eat any meat. And you go to, in Japan, where it's kind of much more ambivalent about these things. The monasteries, there's no meat that's ever cooked in a monastery. Though if the donations are given in cooked meat, then they'll eat it for the evening dinner. The evening meal is kind of like, it's called the medicine meal, and so you're allowed a little bit more leeway there, what you do. But they don't cook meat in the monastery. But in China and Korea, they don't eat any meat. In Tibet, the monastics eat lots of meat. Probably every meal, there's meat in it. So there's that kind of range. And in the time of the Buddha, one of the main sibling traditions of renunciants was the Jains. And the Jain, they still exist in India, Jain religion, Jain followers. Whereas Buddhism kind of died out in India, Jains have stayed all this time. And the Jains, the time of the Buddha and since, have a very strong, very, very strong emphasis on ahimsa, nonviolence, and they're really into being vegetarian. So the monastics at that time, they were the example in the time of the Buddha of monastics, renunciants who were vegetarian. And so what is it for Theravadan Buddhists? You know, what do they do? Theravadan Buddhists, how do they see the ethics of eating meat? And it turns out that that's a little bit ambiguous, or there's a quandary around this for Theravadan Buddhists, because it's relatively easy. Most people who want to be vegetarian or think vegetarian or not avoiding meat eating is the ethical right thing for Theravadan Buddhists to do will justify it based on two arguments, two points of view. One is the first precept, don't kill. And even though they're not killing, they feel that there's killing being done for them if they eat meat. If they go buy meat and eat meat, they're involved in the killing industry and they're supporting the killing of animals. And so they're, you know, the first precept for some people is interpreted to mean that I shouldn't be involved in the killing of animals, even buying it. It's a violation of the first precept. The other is arguments of compassion. And the arguments of compassion are compassion for the animals, but also compassion for the butchers. The karma of being a butcher is pretty bad from traditional points of Buddhist points of view. And the Buddha actually talks about, you know, the eons that butchers will spend in hell and for what they do. So, you know, so it's not just the animals, also the people involved in the meat industry. And so that seems good, you know, I guess. And but then there's a quandary, there's a problem with this for Theravadan Buddhists. And that is, the Buddha explicitly refused to require his monastics to avoid eating meat. And he explicitly allowed them to eat meat. There's particular rules for monastics around meat. The rules are that they could not eat an animal, eat the meat from an animal that they saw, heard, or suspected was killed for their sake. Then they weren't allowed to eat it. But otherwise, they're allowed to eat meat, unless it's an elephant, a horse, a dog, a snake, a tiger, a hyena, a anyway, there's nine animals, or human flesh. They're not allowed to eat. And any other kind of meat that was not killed for them, meat that not of those special animals, can be eaten. And if someone came to the Buddha, specifically, and a monk came to the Buddha and specifically asked him to prohibit the monastics from eating meat. And he declined that request. What he said in reply was, I allow monastics to eat meat that was not killed on purpose for them. So then lay people, lay Buddhists, so monastics are allowed to eat meat, clearly, explicitly allowed to eat meat. And the Buddha is the one who allows them to do that. Then he's supposed to be the great arbitrator for ethics. And then for lay Buddhists, the monastic community is held up as being the exemplars of the ideal ethical life. They're that, you know, they represent that. So that's part of their function for many people, is you look for them and they're supposed to be 100% ethical in all these different kinds of ways. And they eat meat. They're allowed to eat meat. So is it ethical to eat meat or is it not ethical? Should the first precept and compassion tells us we should be, and the monastic life, the monastic monks seem to say, no, you don't have to do that. And so we find in Theravadan countries that because monastics eat meat, then lay people feel like it's fine to do that. And that they don't have any prohibition against it. So that puts up a quandary for some Theravadan Buddhism. It doesn't have the ethical coherence, it's hard to come up with a clear, ethical, coherent perspective on the ethics of eating meat. China and Korea, it's pretty easy to come up with a clear ethical argument or understanding or support for being a vegetarian. But Theravadan Buddhism doesn't have that. So here we are. What do we do with that? What do you think? We're kind of Theravada, so.
Helen, Mira, I think you're not purposefully, maybe purposefully being a little sneaky, changing the sentence from there's a prohibition against eating meat. There isn't a prohibition against eating meat if it wasn't killed for you. Two, there's not a prohibition against eating meat, because there's a huge difference between those two sentences.
Oh, yeah. So I don't think I meant to be sneaky. I think that eating certain forms of meat is allowed for monastics. So there's no blanket prohibition against eating meat, which this monk who came to the Buddha asked for, you know, complete. So there's no blanket prohibition. So we could also, lay people can look at the monastic rules around them eating meat, and we could do the same thing. We could avoid elephants and snakes and tigers, and we could also decide, well, if it was, it wasn't killed specifically for me, the people who killed the animal in Kentucky, the chicken, they didn't know me, and so it wasn't killed.
Right. Well, they didn't. The person in Kentucky didn't say, "I'm killing this for Gil." But one can say, when it's in the supermarket, it was killed for a consumer who's coming into the supermarket to buy the chicken, which is, in this case, Gil.
That's one of the arguments. So if you want to use the monastics as an example, then and you're buying meat, then you're clearly, someone had the customer in mind when they killed the animal, and you're the customer. So it could be said they're killing it for you. Mm-hmm. So if the monastic model then would not, that would be one argument. I tried that on Pandita, my teacher in Burma, because there was a very large monastery, meditation center, and there were sometimes 5,000 people there. They had to feed every day. And there were, 500 monks, and we'd eat in this big room, and the amount of pork that was served was astounding. It was like every day piles and piles of pork. So I went to the abbot and said, said something like, there's this law of supply and demand. There's a demand, and so then they supply the demand, and someone must be going from the monastery to buy so much pork every day that the merchants must be planning ahead, because they have to in order to, And so someone's killing with the monastery in mind. And so you're increasing the amount of, death because of this. And he just kind of acted as if he had no clue what I was saying. And the conversation didn't go anywhere.
Tenzin Palmo has said that monastics are purposefully... that's a kind of alibi or strategy.
She comes out of Tibetan Buddhism where they eat a lot of meat.
But she doesn't.
She doesn't.
Yeah.
Ajahn Jeff was teaching Eightfold Path here a couple of years ago, and the subject came up, and he said as a monk, he had to eat whatever people gave him.
This is a common argument. It's not actually true.
Okay.
So I think it has to be, if that's what he said literally, he's not allowed to eat elephants, tigers, snakes, and he's not allowed to eat it if it was given after 12 o'clock. He's not allowed to eat it if it was handed to them in the wrong way. Not allowed to eat it if it had been offered to someone else first. There's all these requirements. To just say I have to take whatever is given to me, when they already have all these, they put all these requirements on people. It's a little bit, if that's what he said, it's a little bit like being sneaky.
Another sneaky person.
I was just thinking maybe... To the degree that might be true, monastics are kind of a special case where they live off of alms food, and so maybe they have a reason for being less restrictive about it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Whereas lay people maybe don't. Anyway, just...
Yeah, yeah. So that's if you're living on alms and you're walking down the countryside and you no one's cooking specially for you, but they're inspired to want to give you food. It's a wonderful donation. And you're not going to expect them to cook special for you. And so then they serve you some of the family food. That's a good argument for just accepting it. And you benefit them, they're happy, and it's nice, and it's good for everyone all around, maybe, except for the animal. So that's one argument. That's kind of what he was trying to say.
Yeah, that's
right. But it's one thing to do that in the, you know, walking around the countryside. It's another when the laity are specifically cooking food for the monastery. And they're not giving you the family food. They're like going shopping and making the food in the morning and serving it in the morning, and it's a whole production. And whenever the monastery said, you know, we thank you for your offer ahead of time and say, you know, but we love receiving food. We appreciate it. It's valuable, and we request the food be vegetarian. Just like they say, we love your food, we love the donation, but we request you offer it before 12 o'clock. And if you slaved all day long, all morning long in the kitchen, you got up at 3 in the morning and you cooked for 6 hours, you got in your car to drive 3 hours, and you drive to the monastery at 12:01. Sorry. It seems a little cruel to me. Sorry. So this idea that you can't ask lay people to do something in those kinds of settings seems a little bit doesn't carry much water. Or, yes?
Well, the Tibetans used to say that at the high elevations they could not grow vegetables.
So,
yeah. The Tibetans
would often say that the reason why they were allowed to eat meat,
right,
that the monastics was because of the elevations and that
people
couldn't grow.
They couldn't live there. Yeah, yeah. And there's also medical reasons why people... So one of the reasons the Buddha probably didn't prohibit meat was that he recognized at his time that meat eating was a... the meat also served as medicinal purposes. And so he explicitly allowed meat to be used for medicinal purposes. And he listed certain diseases and different things that people could use it for.
What was that? I'm just curious.
What?
What diseases were...
I don't remember.
Okay.
Yes?
You all took the words out of my mouth.
Who's this?
I was going to just refer to some of the cultural considerations. Yeah. I don't know what foods were available in the Buddhist time, but... clearly, it wasn't California now.
Yeah.
So we have so many choices.
They
had fewer then.
So
they had been thinking, too, of the health of his monks. I don't know. I mean, a rice diet over time isn't particularly life-giving, is it? And I just suspect that maybe allowing meat was the simplest way of making sure people were getting
well nourished. Yeah, could well be. So the question, you know, so what monastics do, so the reason we're talking about monastics is if we're using monastics as a model or as the reference point for what is ethical and not ethical. And so that's why Theravada has this quandary around this issue, because there seems to be logic in the teachings to be avoid eating meat. And however, these monastics are allowed to eat meat, certain kinds of meat. And so what is it? The quandary goes away if we don't use the monastics as a model. And don't as lay people, don't worry about what's going on with them around meat, and you know, let them take care of themselves. And if you look at this... documentary, so-called documentary that the assignment we'll get will have a link to. There's some wonderful Bhikkhu Bodhi comes out and talks about being vegetarian and promoting it. And it's kind of nice to have Bhikkhu Bodhi hear what he has to say. And there's a whole bunch of monastics, and not so many Theravadins, but he's the only, I think he's the only Theravada. Oh, Bhante Gudaratna, also is a vegetarian, and so he comes out in the video and promoting that. So there are examples. There's nothing prevents a monastic from being a vegetarian. Just the fact the Buddha allowed it doesn't mean that it's required. And then the question is, what's their proper way to receive the donations from laity? And there's something improper about saying no thank you or putting requirements on it. And that's a whole question for monastics to sort out. But if we don't, if lay Buddhists, lay Theravada Buddhists don't use the, just don't consider the monastic issue around it. And we're looking towards the, you don't have to look towards Buddhism for resources and thinking about the ethics of eating meat. But if you do look towards these suttas and about the Buddha's teachings, I think that there is the arguments to be made from the first precept and from compassion. And then the other interesting reason to be a vegetarian, avoid eating meat, is what we read about here, is this idea that one should avoid killing and should encourage others to avoid killing. How do you encourage a butcher to stop killing if you're eating meat? Does that really work? Isn't that kind of odd? You know, you go out for a nice steak dinner with the local butcher and say, I think you need to stop eating meat, and as you gobble your steak down. So this instructions to be actively engaged in promoting the precepts in people, I think it casts some light on this question of if we're really trying to promote non-killing in this world, then how do we participate in a industry that there's a lot of killing involved, and the scale of killing is phenomenal, and what's the karma of it? And now there's all kinds of other issues that come into play around eating meat, you know, the ecological issues. I don't know if I told you here, I told someone recently. Did I tell you about Francis Morlepe and Diet for a Small Planet? Some of you remember the Diet for a Small Planet? Yes. Those of you don't remember it. So it came out in the early 1970s. It was one of the first great kind of books coming out of the counterculture, kind of promoting vegetarianism. But what was unique about this book was it had a big ecological argument. It was half the book was recipes, but the first half of the book was the impact that the meat industry had on the planet and the ecology and the world, and it's pretty detrimental. And so she had all these vegetarian recipes in her book, and it was kind of like, well, lots of communes had the copy of the book. And so when I was late 77, 78 or so, I was studying agriculture at UC Davis, and I was kind of a small cadre of alternative and agriculture activists. So we were organizing different things, and so we had had her come up from San Francisco to give a keynote speech, and she was quite famous. So the biggest auditorium at Davis was filled for this occasion. So we invited her up early that day to have a potluck dinner in the backyard of someone's house. So it's potluck, so she brings something, right? And we're all vegetarian. She shows up with a stew with rabbit meat. And like, what? So I asked her, you know, probably a nicer way than this, but I go, what's going on here? And she said that this is a rabbit that was raised on food scraps from her kitchen. And this is an ecological way of raising meat-eating animals. It's efficient. There's not any waste. It actually does better, you know, improves things rather than things going in the landfill, food going in the landfill. So for her, this was an ethical way of eating meat. And so, you know, she wasn't thinking about the animal when she was, promoting vegetarianism. She was thinking about the planet as a whole. So there's all these different kind of ways of thinking. And then, do we want to think that way? Or how do we grapple with these thoughts, these ideas? How do we figure this out for ourselves? what are all the consequences of the meat eating that ripples out and out and out, out into the world? Do we feel like it's what happens beyond what we can see is none of our business and we have no impact on it? Or is that the way we want to spin, you know, our life and what, how we live our life? Which way do we want to spin it? And so what's the ethical way of considering eating meat? And is it appropriate to... Is it appropriate to even make a judgment? It's unethical to have meat when we have, you know, Wendy's not here anymore, but I think, but, you know, some people have, their health are quite compromised, some people, and so meat seems to be the thing that keeps them going and it's very important. It's hard to find a substitute for some people. And so if we make a judgment that eating meat is unethical, that makes them feel pretty lousy, you know. Then is that what we want to do? Do we just make it a private affair that we think about it for ourselves and each person for themselves of this issue? But then what happens to them when we look at society as a large, you know? And I mean, so what's the ethical thing to do? Or more important for the purpose of this program, if you consider meat eating through your inner ethical sensibilities, through the inner source inside of what makes you ethical, and you think about it, reflect on it, and whatever it is that has become ethical in you, how does that come out? How do you think about it? How do you reflect on it? Are there competing ethics involved, and so you have to kind of weigh the different ethics and decide how to balance that. You know, are you kind of like some people will not buy meat or cook meat, but if it's served for them, they will. Sometimes, very occasionally, I'll get like on an airplane or something, meat and it gets put in front of me, beef or something, and I look at that and I think, if I don't eat this, it's going to be thrown away. And that's not good either. So I don't want to eat meat, but I don't want this to be thrown away either. But I want to order, you know, beef or hamburger, you know, and I wouldn't buy it. So how do we find our way with this? And that's kind of where I wanted to leave you. I didn't want to, you know, clearly I have an opinion, right? So I apologize for that, and that I couldn't keep it better contained. But I really wanted to leave it this for the end of the day with this kind of this encouragement that you spend time reflecting on this, and not that necessarily you're supposed to change anything you do, but that whatever you're doing around eating meat, that this is well considered on your part. And you can clearly articulate why you're doing what you do and how you feel it's ethical or how you see it in terms of or in compromised ethics or what you're weighing, what the values you're weighing, what's important and not important. And so if someone sees you eating meat or not eating meat, that you can clearly, you can say, this is, I've thought about it, and this is my understanding, or this is how I see it now. And my hope is that if you can do that, regardless of what decision you made about meat eating or not, if you can, in a clear, well-thought-out way, explain the ethics of it to others, that you'll inspire people to be more ethical. Regardless of whether or not you eat meat, for them people to witness someone who's given that level of thought and care, I think could be quite inspiring. So, that's the... And then, so we have one more meeting, and I was a little bit shocked some weeks ago or something when I realized that. I thought we had more. And so I wanted to look at a lot more of these social issues, But then I said, well, we're over soon, and I could add more. And probably not. And and I'm not quite sure what to do. So I wrote an article about this, Should Buddhists Avoid Meat, that I wrote, that said some of the things I said here. And there's an article by Sujato. He's a monk in Australia who very clearly thinks that Buddhists should be vegetarian. So it's kind of interesting to read that. And then there's this video you can read, I watch if you want to see it, with Gunaratana and Vikabodhi and Guy Armstrong and Sally Armstrong. Richard Shankman's in it. And a whole long parade of Buddhist teachers of all kinds of traditions. There was some organization it's a non-profit or an organization whose purpose in life is to encourage vegetarianism. So it's clearly a propaganda machine, a propaganda movie. I mean, it comes across that. I mean, it's clearly that's what it is, but I think it's worth looking at. And so I'm not quite sure what to do for the send you the 2 weeks before that we finally end. So I'm still, that's in process, and so I'll figure that out. So, and then we'll somehow, the next time we meet, we'll somehow bring this to some kind of wonderful conclusion, and about how this 8 months on reflection on ethics, how that has benefited of us. So thank you. And if you could help with the chairs, that'd be great. And also, I don't know if any of you have a little teeny bit of time to look at the bathroom and just make sure that they're in good shape.